and welcome to Method Reactor, the podcast. You know that because you're listening. You click and play. I'm Brett, and I'm here with TJ.
What's up?
I wonder if we would like, if like Spotify would like autoplay us after some. I'm trying to think of some, like, what could come alphabetically. Does Spotify even work that way? I don't know.
I don't know. We've never done this. I mean, before. I totally listen to Spotify. Do they care? Do they care if we what we say? It's like, I love Spotify. I also love, I listen to this on Spotify and Apple. And yeah, all the other cool podcast apps that you could possibly do it. I love them all equally.
I listen on my IBM and on my Apple phone and my Nissan.
I listen on my refrigerator. Any place I can, I listen to podcasts. We're here today with a story of, two longtime friends getting back together to make a little more magic. I'm not talking about the rep. I'm talking about Brent and TJ. We are back. Right. It's the first episode of the new podcast. If anyone remembers us from the Talkie Talk days,
welcome.
Pour one out for the old media by us. So we are going to be talking about The Rip, the new Matt Damon, Ben Affleck film from Netflix. Is it from Netflix or did Netflix buy it? Do you know this?
I think it's from Netflix.
Okay.
It's distributed by New Line, but I could be completely honest with you, for a guy doing a movie podcast, not really sure what that means at that point.
But we will start with a classic segment from the Talkie Talk days. What we've been watching. Is there anything you want to talk about for before we get into The Rip? Is there anything you've been watching lately?
Yeah, I've been death racing.
Okay, so anyone out there doesn't know
don't explain it. Nope.
It's not like the David Carradine movie?
Yeah. Now Death Wish is in my head because we're about to talk Carnahan.
Yeah.
I think, didn't he try to do Death Wish? He wrote Death Wish. He got fired from directing Death Wish.
Yeah, it's one of the movies this guy got fired from.
Yeah. Anyway, Oscar Death Race is what the Redditors have called, just trying to get them all watched, all the nominees watched before the ceremony.
So how many movies this year are nominated? Is it, including shorts, is it 50?
I think it's 50, which is a lower number than most years.
It's been in the 60s before.
Yeah, it should be doable. There's a couple of surprise noms that just aren't getting any distribution at all.
And where are you at?
I did it for the,
as far as total movies.
Total movies, I don't know. I'd have to count, and I've been told that's bad podcasting.
You mean people? But people, man, I don't know. If we mark this as a math podcast or a counting podcast, some might love it.
But for toddlers.
Yeah, right. That's true. It's not real math.
58.4% of nominations, so that would count movies like Sinners 16 separate times.
Right. Are you looking at my stats, too? Where am I?
Yeah, you're at 56 flat.
Okay.
So, and me and you don't have a lot of crossover. I still haven't seen Sentimental Value.
And
I think that's the big one. And then you haven't dove into shorts or docs or anything.
Seen a single short or doc.
If you go to the Oscars Death Race subreddit, for anybody who's interested, there's a guy there who created a free website where you can go track everything you've watched. And he got partnership with the Animation Showcase, and you can go create a free account there and stream all the animated shorts for free, legally, legitimately. And we blew through all those, my wife and I did, one night. I mean, under an hour to watch all five. So they're quick. And they're always the most fun, and then the doc shorts are always the worst time of your life. They're just gut-wrenching every... There's never a documentary on, the a food race eating corn on the cob or something cool. It's always war or child death.
I was about to say, I haven't even really delved into reading them. And I don't, this might be a feature doc actually that I saw, but the first description for any doc nominated this year just said, it's about a couple in the last year of their life, or one of them is in the last year of their life, and it's about them spending time together. And I was I'm not in the mood for that at the moment.
Yeah, I will say I watched, we both watched Hamnet last night as of this recording, and it was great. Chloe Zhao's a master at what she does. Mm-hmm. Probably not my favorite of hers, but great nonetheless.
Yes. No,
but
Eternals.
The only... Yes. Yeah. Yeah, I wanted more like laser eyes in Hamnet. I didn't get enough. All the Empty Rooms is the only doc short I've seen, and it's about a guy who wants to do a photo series of the rooms of kids who have been horribly, sadly, long since passed from school shootings. It was great, but that is a perfect example of what you usually get in a doc short at the Oscars.
Yeah, but five of them.
Kind of thing is... Right, yeah, yeah. Yeah. Never a fun time in those. I don't know why. Because there are fun documentaries that are great. We both had Mind the Gap in our top 10 8 or so years ago. And it had emotional moments, and it was sad at times, and there was death and stuff in it. But it wasn't just a, like, stab you over and over again.
I feel like I rarely get a lot out of the doc shorts. They're either, like, the most amazing ones really are just miserable, or they pick kind of really random things, so it'll just, like, the one about the, was it the music teacher last year that was just sort of like, it's fine, it's not that interesting.
I enjoyed that I didn't cry a lot.
Yeah, that's it. True.
That was nice.
One of my favorites has been the one about the prison teaching inmates to cook. That one was really good, and that's uplifting, and it's like,
that one was good.
It's not a miserable documentary.
They have been better the past couple of years. Maybe since COVID, there was like a, let's try to lift everybody up a little bit and not just be so sad. And I'm not saying don't make sad movies. There's terrible stuff going on out there. I'm not coming at it from that angle. But there was one last year that we really liked about. It was a charity that specialized in making sure like the Black community got, like, their due diligence was done with them, like, applying for business loans and mortgages, which I know is a big thing. And I was like, this is important and good. So,
I still remember, this must have been, like, 10 years ago, when it's just after we had started doing Talkie Talk. I think we bought or rented all the shorts. So, all 15 nominated shorts. And we watched them in one night at Chris's house. And... The first one we put on and watched was like a 39-minute documentary about people on the cusp of death. And I was hoping that might be an outlier. It was not an outlier. It was a whole evening of that.
Also, for all the animated shorts are like, 8 minutes. It's a short or whatever. The doc shorts, they push it, man. They're like 39 and a half minutes, whatever it is. They go for it. But yeah, I don't. I'm having fun with it this year. It's a deep field in the like top ballot categories.
Yes.
Even the outliers who are like not in Best Picture noms. So I think we've both seen Rose Byrne nominated for Five Legs I Kick You, and it's great. I mean, her performance is better than the movie.
Yeah.
But
I really liked the movie too. I thought it was really effective.
The movie was good.
I was surprised by how much I enjoyed that movie.
So I've been blowing through those. We hadn't watched much else, even like TV. We've been Oscar watching.
Yeah, Death Race is always it starts off fun and then it starts to feel like work for me. I know you do a good job of splitting up the trying to work in the fun stuff as you go, or maybe save a few fun things for.
Man, there's not fun stuff this year. It's tough this year. They're like, usually it's visual effects or something where you get to throw in like, you know, some Marvel movie or something. And this year it was, I mean, visual effects was Avatar, which I haven't seen yet. I think you have. F1 nominated for Best Picture, and then Sinners, The Lost Bus, which was a dark thriller, and Jurassic World Rebirth, which dark thriller for other reasons. not a lot of like. I mean, I'm waiting for Zootopia 2 to drop on Disney Plus.
That's fun.
That's a good palate cleanser.
It's a real easygoing movie. I don't think it's I don't think it's a tough watch at all.
You've been watching anything?
Well, I've also been I've been death racing, not quite as hard as you, but my wife and I have been watching some TV shows. We recently finished the first season of The Studio on Apple, and I highly recommend it. I know you've been waiting on my recommendation after it won Emmys and Golden Globes, but like, well, we gotta see what Brent thinks before we can really commit to this award-winning, critically acclaimed show. But it's if anybody doesn't know, it's Seth Rogen is the star, and he plays the he in the first episode he becomes the head of a studio. He has good intentions, kind of all the way through. He wants to be artistically focused. He doesn't want to be just a studio head who's focused on the bottom line, but he has bosses and people who don't care about art. And it's sort of the whole series is about his like push and pull against that force that's kind of pushing him towards commercialism. Every episode's kind of its own thing, and it explores a different facet of like studio movie making, and it's hilarious. It's really, really funny. It's each episode just turns into a disaster of his own creation, despite his good intentions. I think the highlight for me was an episode about a long take.
Is that shot in a long take?
Did yes, I read that also. Yeah.
Okay.
So
yeah.
There's a lot of mirroring from like the topic into like how they make the episode too, which That's is fun. A lot of great, great guest stars. Ron Howard guest stars, and they're all mostly playing themselves. And like Ron Howard, Martin Scorsese in the first episode is fantastic. Great cast too. There's oh my god, what's his name? It's the guy who won Celebrity Jeopardy.
Ike Barinholtz.
Ike Barinholtz. Yes, thank you. He's one. He's like number two in the studio. He's really good. And then of course the late great Catherine O'Hara.
Sadly, the late great. One of my wife's. Probably my wife's favorite actress. I can't imagine who else it would be.
Yeah.
From someone who has like Home Alone and Beetlejuice and Best in Show in their top 10.
Yeah. It was a painful. I found out when David texted us.
Us, me too.
And it was, I was just gutting. I was, I kind of did that thing where he was like, I hope I'm thinking of the wrong person. Like I'm checking the name against, like double checking. Like, he must mean someone else. That was really.
Yeah.
A sad loss.
Super sad. But she had a great run, man, at the end. Jesus.
Oh.
Schitt's Creek and The Studio and the big Christopher Guest movies are, I know me and you, like, just love, capital L love, A Mighty Wind.
Especially her in that movie, too.
Yeah, and she performed an Oscar-nominated song. Should have won. I love Lord of the Rings, but no. I think it lost to... Is it Enya? Or is that just like me making it up?
Yeah. David and I did an episode on A Mighty Wind for Here Are the Nominees, and that's the only thing, the only category we could talk about. But it was The Triplets of Belleville had the song Belleville Rendezvous, Mighty Wind, and then there were two songs from Cold Mountain. That were nominated that year, but you are... No, it's Annie Lennox.
Oh, Annie Lennox. Okay, well, she's way better than Annie. Sorry, West. Annie Lennox. I love you. You're great. You shouldn't have won an Oscar it's that year. It would have been funny if it was like Mary and Pippin singing that like jig they sing in the little bar.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's the Oscar for Best Original Song.
Wouldn't shock me if that wasn't original, if Tolkien had written that in one of his... like.
Yeah, it would actually shock me if he didn't, probably.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Now
let's rip it.
Yeah, okay, so obviously it's a brand new movie. It's the first 2026 movie that I've seen. I think it's your second?
What's first for me?
Did you see that rom-com on Netflix?
Oh, yes, I did. Sorry.
The People We Meet on Vacation, People You Meet on Vacation.
Yeah. It's hard for me because I feel like with the death race always bleeding into the new year, I'm like, I forget that all these are 2025 movies, so I need to start a new 2026 Google Doc because I'm bad at Letterboxd.
Yeah, and so once I start my 2026 list, this is number one. The best movie of 2026 for me is The Rip.
Me too. Even better than the other one.
Okay, so yeah, I mean, overall, I will start off by saying I mostly like this movie. I like most things about this movie except for the script of this movie. and that's a pretty big part of the skeleton of a movie.
So, but I want to, in my talking about movies, start figuring out, when you say script, are you talking dialogue? Are you talking story? Or are you talking both? Does it change? Is it fluid? Does it depend?
I think in this case, it might depend. It might be fluid. In my case for this movie, I think it is both dialogue choices and like the way the story is told. Because I think at its core, this is an interesting story. And I don't know if the movie, and I guess I would blame the script, I don't know if it tells it in the most interesting way at times. I don't have a quick fix to that. I'm not the screenwriter here, though.
We'd make a worse movie, for probably. Sure.
Well, I don't think I could get Matt Damon or Ben Affleck to be in it. So,
yeah, true. But even with them, I'd find a way. I would just let Ben Affleck do everything.
I mean, the first day is like, how do I work these cameras? I don't know. Technically, anything that I'm doing.
So I do think they told the story in a bad way. And I do, we talked some in like our little pre-show chat about Matt Damon, I think, going on record of how hands-on Netflix is, which can be annoying. So I don't necessarily want to blame Carnahan or the production or the actors or anything. But I do think the way the story was told was poor. It was convoluted and confusing. And both at the same time. I think they reiterated stuff, but they didn't reiterate it in a good way. I do think some of the dialogue, especially in the reveal, was pretty good, but that could have just been Matt Damon being a good actor. I don't know.
Should also at this point out that these will always be spoilery podcasts. Like, I'm not really worried about trying to find the exact point in the movie to stop talking about details.
Yeah,
unless it's a movie that like completely hinges on some major thing, in which case we'll give extra warnings, I guess, if we're going
to
talk
about. Yeah, it. I mean, I'll just say now, like watch The Rip and then listen to this one, and if you don't want to watch The Rip, you can if you want to, but just listen to the next one.
Right. Okay, so at the beginning, the movie starts with kind of thrown into action. Like, there's a cop who's on the phone, and she's on the run, and she gets hunted down and executed sort of, you know, cartel style on a beach, which we later find out is in Miami, or a waterfront, rather. And we immediately cut from there to police headquarters, where different police officers are being interrogated or just interviewed by Nestor Carbonell, great character actor from Lost. It's Richard from Lost. Love Nestor Carbonell.
Yeah. All right.
Yeah. He's also in The Dark Knight, maybe? Anyway. But he is he's questioning them all, and I was kind of confused about what happened at the waterfront a little bit. Like, I don't know. I think at this point is they start editing the interview scenes, and I actually think it's sort of, I don't know, it seemed to me like a bit of an homage to Inside Man, the way that, do you remember in Inside Man when Denzel and Ejiofor, is that who he's with in the movie?
Yep, his partner. Yeah,
when they're interviewing all the people who are in the bank, and it's cutting, they ask somebody one question, and then someone else will answer the same question. And then it cuts. And they're doing the same thing here in The Rip. You could say they ripped it off, possibly. But
and I was also confused, I will say. But really, like 30 minutes into the movie, I realized all you need to know about the first part is their captain was murdered.
Yeah, the leader of their squad.
You really don't need to know anything else. Yeah.
And Matt Damon was the number two under her.
He had recently promoted.
Right, and you sense that there's friction between him and Ben Affleck about who, you know, that he got the promotion and Affleck did not.
Yeah, who play like best friends.
But it really just introduces us to the team, and they're all looking for the person who did this. And then there's Ben Affleck's brother is a, not Casey Affleck, Fed. But his in-film brother.
Fictional brother.
Some guy I did not recognize is a Fed who is kind of blaming Ben Affleck, is like suspiciously pointing the finger at him. He's kind of pointing us in Ben Affleck's direction, which is strange then when you find out he's his brother.
Yeah, you kind of don't know if it's actually, or if it's like him messing with his brother, I guess.
Yeah.
But.
Yeah. We also meet there's a DEA task force. We meet them at the beginning of the movie too, and it's led by Kyle Chandler, playing agent.
Always happy to see Kyle Chandler in a movie I'm watching.
Yes, of course. He's
just one of those guys.
He makes every role better just by being in it.
Yeah.
'Cause this could have been a very, in fact, all of these parts could have been very throwaway parts in just some boilerplate movie, but it's a strong cast. The other members of the police department are Detective Mike Rowe, played by Steven Yun. I looked that up and read it, and I still messed it up.
Let's at least be consistent. We have no idea if we're right.
It's true. I think it's Yun.
Yun.
Teyana Taylor, recently nominated for Best Supporting Actress, plays Numa. And Catalina Sandino Moreno plays Lolo. And that's the cast of cops in this movie. Pretty soon after we meet everybody, that's like all we have time to do, right? And then they Matt Damon gets he pulls up the text on his phone, and he's got a tip for a house that has a bunch of drug money, and they're gonna go seize it.
And that is what this team does.
Yes,
like that is their main job,
is seizing drug money.
Yeah. That's how I heard it.
Anyway. Yeah,
a little confused again, but that's what I picked up on.
So then they all hit the road and go to Hialeah. So they go to the house, and it's has one resident. It's a young woman named Desi, and she lets them in. She lets them search the place, and they find. Well, I guess we should first say Matt Damon tells everybody a different amount, and they make a point of showing that. And I actually think that's a strength of the script where it fails in other areas, is that they actually show us that. They show us him, and you notice it. And also they give the audience enough credit to not like have him step aside and say like, I'm going to tell everybody different amounts for this.
You don't see his notepad where it's like, JD 150. Right.
You just see him tell everybody. You notice, and I noticed, and I thought, oh, this is interesting. He's telling them different amounts.
Yeah, it worked on me at the time. So Brent and I watch movies a little differently. I think not completely. My wife never tries to solve anything in a movie ever. Drives me crazy. I am the opposite. I'm bad about it. But immediately then, I was like, Damon's the bad guy. So
it certainly has you wondering. It has you wondering, like, what's he doing? What's up? There's something weird about his process here. And that becomes like the major focal point of most of the plot, which is the whole team realizes there's something strange about his actions along the way. But yeah, he's telling everybody a different amount. He tells one person there's going to be about 75,000 here. We're expecting to pick up 150. And then they get to the house and they find $20 million. In drug money there.
Which is for people who don't deal with cartel money, off the charts. Unprecedented find.
They talk a lot about that it's a problem, that the tip doesn't match the rip. And is it just because it's a scary amount of money? Like, what makes the $20 million more, like, I guess, like, why wouldn't $300,000 be scary, too? Is that just nothing?
I just think it's my take on it. Again, the easy answer is I don't know, but that's a boring answer too. I think it's, yeah, I think like the cartel will send an army for $20 million.
Okay. And they just.
Because they make that reference later in the movie, which is kind of when I came to that realization where they're like, The cops, the cartel even knows it's not worth it.
Yeah.
To start right. killing cops. If they're not willing to kill cops over 20 million, I assume they're almost never willing to kill cops over 100,000, 200,000.
So the 300,000 is just, would probably be considered a just cost of doing business.
That's the way the cops in the movie told me.
Yeah. Okay.
This is the case. Yeah.
So anyway, most of the movie is at this house and they are, I mean, how would you even describe what all they're doing? Like, two of them are counting it. Then Steven Yeun's just sort of, what, being a lookout?
So Steven Yeun's, like, watching the outside.
And Matt Damon collects everybody's phone, except Steven Yeun hides a burner and texts somebody about it. Ostensibly, Matt Damon's not doing things by the book, is what he is texting someone.
Yeah. He also says, like, big dollar signs, though. So you start then where considering Yun as the bad guy.
Right. So, and again, we said we were going to not worry about spoilers here. He turns out to be the bad guy. Is that, did the movie give it away too early to make it a reveal later?
So I considered at one point that there might be, like, either two sets of crooked cops, or Yun is working with the cartel and there's also crooked cops. So I didn't necessarily think that one answer was the solve for the movie. Right. But you do, I think, know 100% that Yun is not on the up and up. He's not like calling command and being like, the lieutenant's making weird decisions. He is like clearly texting somebody that they should come take this money.
Whereas Affleck is doing the other thing. He is more concerned, or at least it seems to us that he is more concerned about protocol. Yeah.
But then, to move the plot forward, he goes and inspects a light that's...
I will say that the reveal of all the houses coming on out in the, like, I really like that scene. And I was reading a little bit about it because I often like to look up the special thanks at the end of the credits and to see who the people are and why they were thanked. And the director, Joe Carnahan, talked a little bit about a couple of them. William Goldenberg and Christopher Rouse were two of the names that were special thanks. And they're both editors. In fact, most of the people that were special thanks were editors in Hollywood that he's worked with before. And apparently they visited the set and they gave him a note on that particular scene. And he took it. And is that after the cops have pulled up, or do the cops come up after that?
The cops come up before that.
Okay. The dumbest line in the movie for me was when the cops are sitting there staring at them and they're just standing out in the middle of the street and Steven Yeun says, they know we're here. I'm like, yeah, they know you're here. You're standing in the middle of the street, man. And there's a police car like pointed nose at you, like, I don't know, 30 yards away. It's not far. And that's again, that feels like a Netflix note. That line.
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe it's not.
That scene also got me a good laugh because a little bit of the Boston slipped out in Matt Damon when he was talking to the cop. He was like, can you turn your bar off? Your light bar? Yeah. I was like, hey, there he is.
I also noticed with one of the phones that somebody was texting with, the speakerphone button was on the right and it was on an iPhone. And that was weird to me because aren't speakerphones on the left?
I don't know. I'd have to call you to look. Yeah. But I will say this.
Don't answer. Okay.
I didn't know. So Ben Affleck goes away, essentially talks to the cartel. And the cartel, you find out, is like not part of this. They don't want any part of it. And Matt Damon, the lieutenant, also doesn't want any. So they're like, cool. It's not the cartel.
Take the money.
They seem to make that very clear in the movie. The cartel is not involved in this movie. And I appreciated that.
Yes.
Because it removed a whole thing I didn't know about. But what I will say is, while you were still, you didn't know if it was, you knew Yun was bad. You didn't know if Damon was doing it good for good reasons or was trying to steal the money. You didn't know anybody else being good or bad at this point. And Ben Affleck has his phone goes off and it's an iPhone noise right before that. Yeah. And I was like, well, he's not bad. Because I think that's still a rule with Apple, is that you can't use their products. Villains can't use their products in movies.
Really?
Yeah.
I did not know that.
Yeah.
That becomes a storytelling problem.
I know. And that's why you'd never see iPhones in movies, really. Unless it's, like, clear. Like, Ryan Gosling in La La Land or whatever. Yeah. Like, a movie without a bad guy, you know. But, yeah.
That is some weird stuff. Like, is Apple really worried that one movie...
Sorry. I think it's, like, impossible to, like, prove that that's a thing. But, like, it is widely accepted that that is the case.
I've never heard that. That's great.
There's no examples of it happening. So that happened like right after the Damon Affleck fight.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh man, that's bad job.
That's funny.
Because we know Ben Affleck's good now.
We were talking about the cartel. They talk to the cartel.
Also a good
scene. That is a good scene. And then it's undermined by them going back and explaining it to each other afterwards in the dialogue.
Another Netflix
thing. So annoying. Like, give us some credit. Like, whether the cartel makes it pretty clear. He's just like, no, we don't want any violence over this. We would not do that. We would have no violence whatsoever. And then they walk back to the house and he's just like, so the cartel wouldn't want any violence for this reason, for A, B, and C. And it's just, like you said, just really annoying that they have to explain the thing that just happened 30 seconds ago. Because people might be on their phones looking at Facebook while this is playing in the background.
Or watching on their phones and they had to go to the bathroom.
Yeah. Oh.
The merger is bad.
By the way, when Ben Affleck... I think it's when Ben Affleck goes into the cartel house. Is that where there's a movie playing on a TV? When he's walking through there?
Oh, yeah.
That is... What's the movie? Blood, Guts, Bullets, and Octane. Joe Carnahan's debut film from 1998.
Nice.
So, I got little bits of trivia, but,
all right.
You know, I feel like most good directors would just pick out a movie that inspires them instead of just putting one of their own movies in the movie. You have this opportunity. It's like putting a poster on a wall, but whatever. So anyway, what happens before they leave the house? When they wrap up at the house? How does that end?
So at the time, you think Damon is... You hear a conversation that he has with the two female lieutenants, or detectives.
Oh, like, do you girls want to cut of this? And, yeah.
Yeah, look, we need to get paid or whatever. It does feel, in my opinion, it felt like he was laying it on a little thick. The character acting in that moment was a little much. But, which it ended up being in the end, where he was like, you heard exactly what I wanted you to hear. And I was like, okay, well, Matt Damon's a great actor. This lieutenant, not so much.
Yeah.
But after that, it's Lieutenant Matt Damon's character, Ben Affleck's character, Steven Yeun's character. They finally get saved by Maddie, the DEA agent played by Kyle Chandler. And he tells the female officers to stay behind with the girl from the house and essentially wait because they need medical.
And so then they're all inside the like a SWAT van type vehicle and they are with the bags of money and they are en route to wherever they're headed, and that's when you kind of see Matt Damon kind of lay out everything that's happened so far. And
it's the Ocean's 11. The Ocean's 11 scene.
Yeah. And he j'accuses Steven Yeun right there in the van.
Yeah.
And Matt, yeah. So.
Yeah. He figured it out.
He did. And then he just, he explained that the whole thing was a ruse to, well, sort of not really a ruse, but she, it was a legitimate tip. It was real drug money, but he structured the rip and their operation in a way where he could find out who, find the person who might be connected to her death. And it worked. I wish there was, and this is sort of where, when I talked about like the way this it's a good story, and the way that it was told was not that interesting to me at times. And I think it's with this a little bit where, first off, I wish I had more reason to suspect the two female cops somewhere along the way. I think that
they were pawns the whole time.
And,
it felt like.
You know, you never really thought that they were behind anything. I wish they both had more agency in the movie. And I also wish there was a better way than Matt Damon just sort of Ocean's 11-ing the whole thing at the end, which is like, this is how we did it. And this is what I was doing.
Yeah.
And when I fought Ben Affleck, we were really just, you know, doing it all to lift Steven Yeun's phone. And I'm not saying I have the better way to do it, but that's also the screenwriter's job to figure that out. So as
I was watching it, one thing that kind of annoyed me was you got the female detectives were never really made. You were never led to believe they were the mastermind of anything. So that leaves you with Matt Damon, Ben Affleck, Steven Yeun, and then Kyle Chandler. The cartel's ruled out, I think, very clearly, pretty early in the movie.
Yeah.
There's nobody else in the movie.
There
was nobody else, Steven Yeun, to be texting. I was like, he's texting Kyle Chandler. There's nobody else in the movie.
I mean, it could have been Nestor Carbonell, which is, seems
unreal. Yeah, it could have been an FBI.
And it could have been Ben Affleck's brother.
But that doesn't make any sense
either. It doesn't.
So I was like, he's texting Kyle Chandler. He's got to be.
Also, like, there's nobody else. Those two characters are very buttoned up at the start. And then Kyle Chandler like rolls into the parking lot, basically yelling "Rock and roll!"
Time. He's like swinging his gun on his finger or whatever.
Yeah, and it's like, okay, so it's just the guy who it was most likely to be the only other character in this movie that might have done this is the one who did it.
Right. It reminds me of you like watching the miniseries on Netflix
Wednesday.
Yeah, where you were just like, it's her, isn't it?
Yeah, when it's a cast full of people that aren't real big stars, and then who's it? Christina Ricci? Is that who it is?
Yeah, could have been. Yeah,
Christina. Sorry for the Wednesday spoilers. Right in the middle of a RIP review, but
it could have been Gwendolyn. Oh, what's her name?
Christy? Is that her name?
Cap. Yeah.
Yeah.
She's a big star, man. Captain Phasma, that weird Star Wars character. Didn't matter at all.
Yeah.
You want to riff on Star Wars now a little bit? I feel like
it all connects
morph into a Star Wars.
Right. I wish that if you're going to do a single setting locked room mystery kind of, or at least a riff on that, then give everybody in the room or the house in this instance, give them more, put them on more equal footing. And I wish a little more time had been devoted to Teyana Taylor and Catalina Sandino Moreno, their characters.
Or, and again, we are not I'm not a screenwriter, so I'm not saying it's a... But the other time that works is when it's a clear is it or isn't it thing. So like Cloverfield Lane, there's some number before that movie.
10?
Yes, but I was thinking about that when I was thinking of films that are primarily set in one place. Yeah. But that film works because the question you're trying to solve is just... Is there alien or is there no alien? And that's all that matters.
And the brilliance of that movie is that it makes you ask that question, and it never really asks you to think about a third possibility.
Yeah.
And so I think that's a great movie. But moving on with the plot, they are in the van, and then they
figure it out.
They figure it out.
They tell us what happened.
And then the van is... What, attacked by the other, by his other dirty DEA guys? How do they get separated? So it winds up with Damon chasing down Steven Yeun and Affleck chasing down Kyle Chandler.
Kyle Chandler.
I don't really know how they got separated. I didn't really care.
Well, I mean, they fight in the car once Kyle Chandler realizes he's been made.
And the car scene's great.
And I think That's kind of where the movie should have ended, in my opinion. But I think one of them ends up in like the cab of the tank truck thing, and they kind of slide out at the FBI blockade, because Damon has set this up so perfectly. I mean, it really is like Ocean's 11 style perfectly. That there's no way. But then they turn right in the car. And there, nobody was blocking them over there.
We keep comparing it to Ocean's 11. And I think it's good because it also... The difference in the movies is also like why it works so well in Ocean's 11. Because in Ocean's 11, you are aware that this is a heist. And that this is like a... These are con men. And they are... And so you want to know how they did it. You are sitting there thinking, I can't figure out how they're doing this. How did they do it?
And there's on a rewatch of that movie that is super rewatchable, there are like super obvious breadcrumbs around. Where George Clooney's like, we need to build a replica of the vault. And they're like, oh, for practice? And he's like, sorta.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay. If I paid more attention on the first watch, I probably could have put that.
Right. And that's... and but it's really rewarding at the end when because that's what you've really been waiting on. You've been waiting to find out how they did it. And then in this movie, you don't even realize there's a ruse until... Or at least the movie doesn't make it clear that there's a con going on until...
Not, I mean, if you're not paying real close attention, not until they're in the
it's like the seconds before they reveal what happened. Or even during the reveal is when you find out that it was a con of sorts. Yeah, that's why it didn't work as well for me in this movie, but it does in something like Ocean's 11. I will say this about the ending of the movie. I did like when Affleck kills Kyle Chandler. There's a spliced in edit of the girl from the beginning, the leader of the team. Did you catch that?
Oh, yeah.
That it's like her over Affleck's face as he pulls the trigger. And actually, I like that cut. I like that edit. I actually thought this was a pretty well-edited movie.
Yep. And I say the movie should have ended there. I didn't like the fighting was too long. And bad editing in that one instance, I think, of cutting back and forth between the Affleck fight and the Damon fight. It was just dark, and they were both kind of in murky places, and... The choreography wasn't anything amazing, but I didn't mind everything at the real count. And honestly, the beach scene felt like I was going to roll my eyes to, and I didn't end up like hating that even.
I kind of got the feeling that the movie was going to end with someone, you know, seeing one more sunrise. And I'm happy.
Yeah.
I'm happy that the movie, while it pits them against each other for most of it, they wind up together and they wind up on the same side. That was, I don't know. I feel like a lot of movies are so cynical these days where it's like one of them has to be behind everything, the evil one. And I'm glad that the two stars of the movie just, I don't know, they're friends off screen and they're friends on screen. And it worked out.
So, I mean, I think that is a great segue into like a more broader discussion about things involving the rip and what we thought of while watching it. But you brought up a great question that I should have asked days ago when we were talking about doing this. And I was talking about, I like rewatched the A-Team while I was on the treadmill the other day. And I was like, at the time, I didn't think you had seen it. So I was trying to compare the A-Team to something recently, and I was having a tough time doing that. And I feel like you asked that question today of like these like kind of not super dumb, but popcorn action thriller heist movies. There were so many more of them, it feels like.
Or at least I was aware of more of them 25 years ago.
Yeah, I think are they just going... I think I mentioned this earlier to you off air, but are they just going straight to streaming now and we just don't
that's,
see them as
That's
much?
What I suspect. I don't know that for sure, and I didn't research my own question that I had, but it is a hard thing to look up. Though, but I do feel like... I mean... You know it as well as I do from we open up streaming services throughout the year to see what's on, to see what's new, what just came. And there's always some movie that just came out.
That I have to scroll past to watch.
Yeah.
The Office and again it's or some, whatever. Yeah.
It'll very often it'll be like recognizable stars, some sort of crime thriller setting. And, you know, some of the streaming services, they'll have the little Rotten Tomatoes score on there, and it'll just be like, it's a 72% on Rotten Tomatoes. I feel like that's what they all are. Everybody thinks they're like, decently, you know.
Between solid 50 movies. And 75, somewhere in there.
When my father-in-law was still alive, I feel like this is the kind of movie he watched all the time on his own. Whenever he was just wanting a movie by himself, there was a movie called I don't know if it's called Safe House or not, but it was about a safe house. It was about like somebody hiding someone at a safe house, and it was like two big name stars in the movie. And
is it Ryan Reynolds and Denzel Washington?
That rings a bell. Could have been that.
I think that might be it. I've seen that. It's not particularly great, but it fits.
It's a similar movie to this. Sure. It's like pretty simple, straightforward plot of, you know, there's going to be some action along the way, and these aren't like terrible movies. And in fact, The Rip's a decent movie. I think it has like I said, I think the flaw in it is pretty sizable for me. But other than that, I kind of thought everything else in the movie was good. Pretty good performances. Actually liked Ben Affleck in this movie, but
would it have benefited from having like any jokes? Because it really didn't. It took itself.
It did, seriously. But also I don't think it kind of. I don't really. The tone didn't really bother me much. I don't think it was like, I don't know, oppressively serious or anything like that. It didn't feel like
me either. It is different from a movie like Safe House, if we're talking about the same movie, or The A-Team, though, which is like action heist comedy.
The A-Team, you know, is very jokey.
Almost. And it,
then you have
which is the only way to remake The A-Team. Yeah, right.
You can't have the character of B.A. Baracus, and I mean, the whole character is a joke, essentially. He's just constantly, he's scared of flying, he loves his van. Like, that's all there is to him. He pities fools. Those are the three things I can tell you about B.A.
The core tenets.
So I don't. Maybe these just don't make money at the box office the way they used to. Because I feel like 20 years ago, this would just been a like, boy, pencil this movie in for 80 to 120.
And I mean, I will say that back in the day when it was $8, $10 movie tickets, we would go to the theater. I mean, even since my wife and I have been together now for almost 20 years. And we dated and we would go to the movies and not know what we were going to see.
Yeah.
Because it was an easy, like, $18 to go drop and go see whatever. And if it was okay, that was fine. And now it's like, man, we better be sure.
Yeah.
That, because you're about to go spend $50.
And I don't think many people, I don't think many people go to the movies that way anymore. Or at least not as many. I don't think we're alone in the fact that we now research what movie we're going to go see. I think that used to be really common.
Oh, yeah. And beyond that, there'll be movies that I think are probably good that I decide to wait on.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's so expensive now. And it's this, like, it's a give and take thing there because
so episode one of the podcast is just Brent clicking his pen, not thinking about the effect that that has. Just constantly clicking the whole.
But there are movies I'll wait on just because the cost is so. I mean, not to mention we both have young children, so that's a whole other reason to not go. Yeah. But even without them, I think it was, especially since the movie pass. I mean, it's gotten so expensive, and it's one reason why I have this. I don't want theaters to go anywhere. I don't want things like the Warner Brothers Netflix merger to happen. I think it's bad, and it's important to have good theatrical runtimes in releases, but they aren't helping by making them so dang expensive.
So I read that this movie, speaking about like talking about grosses and streaming, they worked out a deal with Netflix. It's a unique deal. Normally Netflix just pays a flat rate for movies, but Affleck and Damon, their production company, which is called Artists Equity, they negotiate a deal on this movie that provides everyone involved with the production of this movie a bonus if the movie, quote, performs well on Netflix. And I'm wondering how that's measured.
We don't know, right? Netflix has always kept that, like, swept.
So, but I guess they would have to have, like, I don't know. I mean, surely the Artists Equity would have to have some way of checking, like
they have to be aware of a metric. Yeah,
I guess it's clicks. Is it minutes watched or something?
I don't know. I know that that's not all streaming services thing that they don't make that public. I think Disney makes that public.
Netflix always has kept theirs guarded, I think.
Right. Yeah. But I know, like, the most watched thing in minutes on Disney is not Marvel or Star Wars. It's, like, Bluey. And it has been for a couple of years now.
Makes sense.
Yeah. It's crazy that it's in minutes, though, because each episode of Bluey is 6-7 minutes long. And, you know, every time you watch Endgame, you get, like, every episode of Bluey at the same time.
Kids, man, they laser in and they're okay watching the same thing back to back to back.
Yeah.
And Bluey has lots of episodes, also, but like
adults love that show.
One of my daughters, she this past week has been watching the Super Mario Brothers movie over and over again. She'll finish it. And she's just like, "Can we start it again? I'd like to watch that again." Like, you don't want to watch anything else. And she gets excited during it. It's like she's never seen it before. Sometimes I hear her yelling, it's like, "It's the Mario Karts!"
I tried to rewatch that one not too long ago and could not get through it. So it's big ups to
it's very fine.
Your daughter.
It's just fine. It's a fine movie. It's entertaining.
Yeah.
Okay, so was there anything else you wanted to talk about with this movie?
Would you recommend it to the average person?
Yeah. It's entertaining and it has two big movie stars in it. And
same. Do you like Matt Damon or Ben Affleck? And do you like a darker heist cop thriller? If you kind of say yes to any of those, I think you'll enjoy it.
What was the last movie where they were both like top two billed? Have they done anything since Good Will Hunting where they've been the top two?
Not top two, I think. Because I think Adam Driver, right, is like top billed in The Last Duel.
Oh, but at least they're both major players in that movie. I guess that's sort of what I'm thinking of.
Yes, they're both in that movie.
Which, yeah, we talked. Did we have any idea why The Last Duel seemed to make no cultural impact whatsoever?
The theory that I came up with when you asked me earlier today was it came out in award season time and didn't get any nominations for anything.
Yeah, so it's when everyone focuses on what gets nominated, things can get lost. Like, there are so many like would-be contenders from this past year that they had like a moment of heat when they first were released, but then nobody's talking about them anymore, which is a shame.
Now, you can't, it doesn't mean you have to be to get views, but if you're going to be like a dark medieval looking, film, and when you're released with that like push, like for your consideration, and then you don't get it, you're losing people who want an awards chase like me, and you're losing people who just want a fun time because they don't want to see the movies that are get nominated or want to be nominated.
I think people just didn't want to stare at those haircuts throughout that movie.
It was bad haircuts.
When I saw the trailer for that.
You said goatees earlier, and I was like, oh, that's like most Ben Affleck movies, though.
So, yeah.
Unfortunate.
I did briefly notice his giant back tattoo in the rip. He was changing clothes at one point, and we got to see that abomination. Yeah, I don't really have anything else that I needed to discuss. I did note, and we talked about it earlier, this is a movie where the director is not the best director on the set because Ben Affleck is a better director than Joe Carnahan, but we don't need to delve too deeply into that. I'm sure that happens.
I've got two good examples.
Oh, let's hear them.
Well, I've got one good example and one question that I think is a fun little debate. So Christopher McQuarrie, I think is his name. He directed a few of the Mission Impossible movies, some of the good ones. He directed Jack Reacher, which was his first Tom Cruise movie, where the main villain was played by Werner Herzog.
Yeah, it's a better director, yeah.
Yeah. And then another huge one, a movie that me and you both love and did a podcast on years ago, is Carol Reed a better director than Orson Welles, The Third Man?
Oh, yeah, that's
because I think you could say either.
Yeah, I mean,
Orson Welles definitely has the better movie.
Yeah,
but not like absolutely. And then I mean, Carol Reed's also got Oliver, which I know is beloved.
I think The Third Man, I think, would contend with most of Orson Welles' things. I do think that Welles has. I mean, he also has Touch of Evil, which is great. I've never seen Magnificent Ambersons, but I know it's highly regarded, and I think the same for F for Fake is another very well-regarded movie. That's a good point. Orson Welles in The Third Man that's a good example. Had he done... Yeah, he had done Kane by then, so... Because that's late 40s, so yeah.
I'm kind of surprised he's in that movie. I don't know... I don't know. It's weird.
It is.
I'm glad he is. Movie's fantastic. But
yeah, and I know when we talked about this earlier, I did mention like Clint Eastwood still acts sometimes, and he's in movies by people who are.
There's those like great actors who became great directors. We talked about that. There's Clint Eastwood. Robert Redford directed a couple of great movies.
And that's what Affleck has done, too. Although I actually think he's an underrated actor, but I think he's a far better director than he is an actor.
Agreed.
I always look forward to his films. They've kind of...
I like Ben Affleck in the right role.
I missed one of his movies. Is it Live by Night? Is that him? I think there is a movie of his from 8-ish years ago. 8 to 15, somewhere. I don't know. Time's a flat circle with me these days. But
Before Children or After Children.
Before Children.
Joke Cass and I make all the time. Yeah. Live by Night or Live by Night, I assume. But I haven't
seen that. I've seen everything else.
I didn't know he actually directed Air. Yeah. Air's another one that's just like a great like throw it on. It's just real watchable.
Recommend Air.
Bunch of likable people.
So that's one where he directed Matt Damon, which is fun. And
he starred in that.
Who did what?
He plays Ben Affleck's in that too.
Yeah, is he?
He's the head of Nike. He's probably like third build.
Oh, okay.
I mean, maybe Viola Davis and Jason Bateman, but nobody else.
Would you say at this point that Affleck and Damon are an iconic on-screen duo, or have they not done enough?
Weird. I wrote a header in my Google Doc for this of famous on-screen pairs to discuss, and I couldn't really like pin down what it is because I feel like they've been that way since Good Will Hunting, and I don't know. It's a very bizarre pairing because they grew up together. They came up together. They did everything together. I guess Courage Under Fire had come out before Good Will Hunting, but Matt Damon was by no way like a household name by that point.
Yeah, I mean he was in. School Ties. Is that the Brendan Fraser movie?
Yeah.
Yeah, where he's like the... Well, they're both in that. Ben Affleck's the bully in that, and Matt Damon's like the privileged a-hole kid?
Yeah, it's been a while, but I think that's right.
Yeah.
And but they were like auditioning for, I think like Matt Damon went out for Ethan Hawke's role in Dead Poets Society. So they were like around that era.
Yeah,
trying to do the same stuff. And then Good Will Hunting came up. They were like, I didn't watch the Oscars live at the time, but from everything I've read and seen, they were like the thing about the Oscars that night that nobody could stop talking about these two kids and how like revered Robin Williams talked about them. And I don't know. So they haven't done a lot together on screen.
Right.
For them to be that way.
The thing I think of after Good Will Hunting is probably their cameo in Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back, where they're filming Good Will Hunting 2 hunting season.
It's probably the best known. I'm partial to Dogma. I actually like that movie.
It's true.
So
I don't think of Dogma because Dogma is notoriously never streaming on anything. So I have not seen Dogma in like 20 years.
We got it on DVD.
That's pretty much the only way to watch it, I think. Although it may have gotten a 4K release actually recently. I'm not sure about that.
But I like that movie. It's fine. But since then, I mean, we looked it up. There's like 18 movies are technically in together if you count like Field of Dreams, where you have to...
Can you even see them?
Eagle eye to find them
in that?
I don't know. I've never looked for like the scene where they are, but I think they're just at the ballpark.
It's Fenway, right? Yeah. It's the Fenway scene.
Yeah.
I don't. I've casually looked before, but I've didn't spot them. Okay, so you did mention that this was a movie set mostly in a single location. Did you want to talk any more about that? Like this was.
I've got two movies that don't really pair well with this, but that are set in almost a single location. So like 80% or more, I would say.
Yeah.
That are probably both in my like top. I don't know. Maybe top 10. Definitely top like 20. Do you want to guess what the two movies are?
Well, 12 Angry Men is set in one location, and that should be. I figured that was in your top 20. Rear Window.
We are
friends.
Those are the two that, like, Yeah.
I know your movies. Yeah, those are great.
Those are the two. There's a bunch that I thought of that are just, but nothing that really felt like this kind of. Have you ever seen The Big Kahuna?
No.
You know what that movie?
No.
I don't think I do. Does that ring a bell? It's starring Kevin Spacey and Danny DeVito, and then the third guy is the like football jock who is breaking up with Jennifer Love Hewitt and can't hardly wait. That's how I picture him. Mm. But it's three guys who are at like a sales conference, and they're in a hotel room the whole time, and it's essentially Kevin Spacey berating the new young guy and Danny DeVito like moderating. Really good movie, I think. I don't think it got good reviews, but I kind of loved it when I watched it the first time. But it's entirely set in a hotel room, and it had the same vibe of this movie where you can't really tell if they're messing with a guy just to mess with him or if they're actually hating him.
Interesting. I think horror does the single setting pretty well a lot. Like Saw comes to mind as a pretty good movie set in just one location. I mean, I guess there are cut scenes away.
Yeah. Cujo.
Oh.
Does
okay.
One scene. I mean, it's all in a car. Ooh, you know what movie that me and you both, Panic Room?
Panic Room.
You about to say
yep.
It? Yeah, it's really good.
Yeah, Panic Room's
love
good.
Panic Room.
And then a movie that...
You told me to rewatch Panic Room like a year ago, and I did. We had a fantastic time rewatching that.
Dwight Yoakam was great in that movie.
It's scary as hell, man. Great villain.
A movie that this film kind of did remind me of in that, like, you have everybody arrive to a location, and then you're... In its ideal form for me, it would have been everybody kind of pointing fingers at each other, and that's reminds me of Hateful Eight, which...
Oh, I thought you were going to say Reservoir Dogs.
Oh, yeah. Man, Reservoir Dogs. Also a kind of a locked room movie. Mysteries are sort of where you see this most, like Gosford Park.
Yes. You've seen this movie, and I would recommend this movie to anybody who likes a very intense... non-gory thriller, but The Invitation. You remember that movie?
Oh, it's a good movie. Yeah.
It's so good.
I love that movie.
So good. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a fun genre. And I think The Rip fits it a little more loosely. Like, there's it's got more at the beginning and at the end than some of these movies do. Like Panic
Room. Yeah, it's not Dial In for Murder. It's, yeah.
But as long as you're feeling...
good
as long as you're getting that feeling of just sort of being locked into this and having to figure things out before you can go. That's kind of does the trick for me.
Any Mount Rushmore talk?
Yeah, this? And that can actually... I put that in the wrong place on the agenda because I kind of want that to overlap with the cast talk. First off, before we do that, who was your standout performance in this movie? Was there one?
That's a good question. I don't know. Most of these guys are so, like... And I say guys without gendering anybody. Yeah. Most of this cast is just professional and... shows up and like does her job, and they're never really bad.
Mm-hmm.
Matt Damon's one of my favorites without like blowing me away in many movies.
Yeah.
With his performance.
He's relatable.
I mean, if I have to throw somebody out there for being good, I'll say Desi's character, I thought was better than I thought she could be. Sasha
Kaye?
Cow?
Yeah.
Apologize if you're listening, or we apologize if you're listening. You're not.
Please contact us if you are.
Yeah. But I thought she was better than I expect from somebody I'd never seen. And
she was good.
She's been in stuff before. I think she's got an Emmy for like a soap opera, I believe.
And she's the one who was in The Flash.
Supergirl.
Yeah. I would probably pick Ben Affleck here. I think he's pretty good in this movie. I don't think that this movie gives people necessarily a lot of opportunity to shine with their acting. I don't think that's the point of this movie. I don't think this movie has like real deep themes or anything like that. This is just an entertaining crime thriller. I think he does pretty well with it. I think the stuff with his brother gives him a little extra to do. That's pretty good. I like it. Also, he gets to be the one.
Yeah.
Constantly voicing our concerns about Matt Damon and what he's doing, which gives him the opportunity to...
Yeah, that's fun.
It's good work. Also, Kyle Chandler always gets a shout-out from me in every movie he's in.
Damn good dog.
But yeah, okay, so you brought up Mount Rushmore, the idea of which we... This is something that comes up a lot in our conversations with each other.
Yeah.
Of, is this movie on anyone's Mount Rushmore? Meaning, is this, first off, a cast member has to be at least notable enough, either in the movie or just in general, to deserve the discussion of, like, do they have a Mount Rushmore? So we're not picking, like, the DEA agent number three. Like, yeah, this is probably one of his greatest films.
Yeah,
the,
or, like,
greatest works.
Who we talked about, like, Teyana Taylor, who's clearly very, very talented in multiple ways and just doesn't have the filmography yet to have that discussion.
But generally, the Mount Rushmore would be, and you can kind of be loose with the definitions. It doesn't have to just be films, but, like, the four works, the four areas of their career that would best help a newcomer understand and experience their career. So if you could boil their career down to, like, four things, and the example I would use is, like, Harrison Ford, you can say Indiana Jones and watch as much of it as you want, but to get a feel for Harrison Ford, you should have experienced Han Solo and Indiana Jones.
Yeah, sure. I only watched the Han Solo story and Kingdom of the Crystal Skull. Those are everything else doesn't exist to me.
Oh, I'm sorry. That would be sad. That makes me sad.
It would be sad.
So, yeah. So, first off, I don't think this is any of the actors in the movie. I don't think this would be on their Rushmore.
I only had three people associated with this movie that I think, I don't want to say, like, deserve a Rushmore. That sounds way too pretentious. But that, like, have a filmography, director, or writer.
Well, at least enough work where we can isolate, like, oh, yeah, they're really good in this.
Right.
And
right,
you should see this. If you like them, you should see this.
So I only have...
I can't do that for Sacha Kaye yet.
Right, yes. Doesn't mean their role in this wasn't good. Or that, like, yeah, Carnahan didn't direct a good movie this time. A fine movie, but I'm not gonna make a Mount Rushmore with the A team on it. Just doesn't feel right. But I think Damon Affleck and Kyle Chandler you can find a good four.
And I think Steven Yeun
for them. He's really close. He's been in at least four great things.
Yeah.
So let's
start with Damon. What's your Damon Rushmore?
Goodwill.
Yeah, gotta be.
The Martian, I think, is probably the second most rewatchable movie of all time. Jason Bourne and the Oceans movies for me.
The Oceans. I hadn't thought about that. Jason Bourne for sure. Good Will Hunting. I would also agree on The Martian. And from there, I actually don't know what I would pick. I don't know. I'm probably forgetting something really good here. I mean, The Departed. He's good in The Departed.
He's very great in The Departed.
He's also very good in Interstellar.
Yeah. He's got a great story about The Martian where he was talking to Ridley Scott and he was like, I can't do The Martian. And they're like, why? He's like, well, it's a small role, but I'm in the movie where I'm alone on a planet. It's a Chris Nolan movie that's coming out. And Ridley Scott's response was, nobody cares.
And he was right.
He was right.
Well, what about Affleck?
I've got Good Will Hunting.
Yeah, gotta be.
Argo.
Yeah. So for him, you have to balance directing and acting. Yeah.
The Town, which I think is an underrated movie.
Yep.
And Gone Girl is my fourth. But I kind of had trouble with the fourth, but I thought maybe his best performance is Gone Girl.
He's so good in Gone Girl. That's such a tough role to accept and nail.
Yeah.
And I think because you have to have, like, a natural unlikability almost to play Nick. And I think his name's Nick in that movie. And he's got it.
Yeah.
Yeah, those are good. I don't know that I would pick... You gotta go Argo. I don't know that I would pick The Town, but I don't have a better
replacement
for it.
Town's so good. I rewatched it the past year. It's great.
Steven Yeun, we briefly talked about. I think his would be a pretty clear top four. You mentioned, what's the Netflix series?
Beef.
Got a lot of good reviews.
Neither one of us have seen it, but was critically acclaimed.
The Walking Dead, I have my problems with that show, but I do think he's pretty good on it. And
he was on the good seasons.
When it was more watchable. Yeah. And his other movies, I think... The two most critically acclaimed that he's starred in are Minari, which I have not seen, but you have?
Yeah, it's fantastic.
He's great. And Burning? Is that the other one?
Yes, Burning.
Burning. Got great reviews, and I've never gotten around to seeing it either. Yeah. And then we have Kyle Chandler, who's kind of the toughest one, other than the first thing on his Rushmore is Coach Taylor from Friday Night Lights.
One of the best, one of the just greatest TV characters ever, man. I just love that dude. I love Coach Taylor. I mean, I love Kyle Chandler too, but it was hard not to love Coach Taylor.
I think he's great in Carol. I would probably have that because it's actually a performance where I think he really does stand out. And he's given more to do than he is in things like Wolf of Wall Street, where he's great, or a handful of Game Night. He's kind of doing in the rip what he does in Game Night, which is just like making everyone uncomfortable with how like rock and roll he is. And he's good in that. He's good in this. He was in a couple of TV shows back in the day. He was in one TV show, Early Edition. Did you ever watch Early Edition?
I didn't.
It was a great premise. My mom and I would watch Early Edition way back in the day. It was about a guy who got tomorrow's newspaper today.
Oh, nice.
And so he could...
I vaguely remember that.
He could, like...
Was it Network?
Yeah, like, I think it like CBS or something.
Yeah.
And so he could look for, you know, things, ways he could help his community with his futuristic newspaper. And then I will also say he's good in, and this is just a personal... a movie that I personally love, but he's really good in Pure Country, which is a George Strait film from the...
It's like his first movie, I think, isn't it?
Who, Kyle Chandler?
Yes.
Yeah, it might have been. So, if you've never seen Pure Country, it's about a country music superstar who basically has... He just, like, has a... I don't know what you would call it, maybe some sort of panic attack, and just walks out in the middle of his tour. Like, imagine Garth Brooks at the biggest moment of his career.
Okay, just so, like, super, super, superstar.
Superstar, just walking away completely. And he cuts off his ponytail and shaves his beard and basically tries to lay low in this, like, farming town in Texas somewhere. And
yeah, if you're a country superstar who wants to disappear, go to Texas.
So he just, yeah, he like this, it's a very like Daniel Day-Lewis type of thing. So he's just like, I just want to work on a farm for a while. It's like, okay. I just want to step away from the fame and just, work on a farm for a while. And while he does that, his manager gets the idea to replace him with his top backup singer and just dim the lights enough on stage where people can't tell he's lip syncing. Okay. So they're playing the tracks because he already was lip syncing. That's like how detached he was from the music. He was just like, he was just going through the motions. And so Kyle Chandler plays the stand in for him.
Nice.
And he's such an a-hole in that movie. He's such a like young punk in that movie. And he's really good at it.
I didn't realize he's in like the new King Kong Godzilla universe, but he was also in the Peter Jackson King Kong.
Oh, is he the good looking actor who's supposed to be the star and he's kind of a coward. Yeah. And then he must be in one of those Godzilla movies.
I've seen all these movies and I don't know. I can't tell you the plot. Godzilla comes. He usually saves the day somehow while killing people.
That's
kind of it. My Chandler was, weirdly, I have the same one. I have a, like, special to me Kyle Chandler. Friday Night Lights, Manchester by the Sea, which I think he doesn't have a lot of screen time in, but he's so fucking good. And then Zero Dark Thirty, I actually remember his role, which he's so good that he kind of blends in. But I thought he was really good in Zero Dark Thirty. But I had Super 8 in mind, where he's, like, the lead adult.
That is a larger role for him.
Movie that I love. Yeah. And it was... early. But man, I'm looking at this now. He had a run in 2011, so starting in 2011 and ending in 2015. His complete filmography in that time is Super 8, Argo, Zero Dark Thirty, Broken City, The Spectacular Now, Wolf of Wall Street, and Carol. I mean, and then he goes Manchester by the Sea right after that. So he was right after Friday Night Lights ended, he went straight into big movies. And I will say about Friday Night Lights, it's not just his character or the show. Like, he's great. in that show. Like, in a show that doesn't have a lot of great acting, he is not that.
Yeah, he's...
And some of the kids come and go with how good their acting is.
It's an all-time great TV performance, I think.
Yeah.
Also, it's a rare TV show where I do think the lead character is the strongest performance on the show, which is not always the case. But with the great shows, it often is. Breaking Bad, The Sopranos, and I think he fits in with those as far as like...
But it did have... It had very young supporting stars that are now some of the greatest actors around.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if you would have
guessed Michael B. Jordan and Jesse Plemons on that show.
When you were watching Friday Night Lights back in the day, I don't know if you would have picked Jesse Plemons as the, like, the one of the crew that was going to be, like, the huge, like, the biggest, maybe, star in 15, 18 years or whatever. But,
Second biggest. Michael B. Jordan, first four seasons or whatever. Yeah. I mean, everybody probably thought Taylor Kitsch was going to be.
I did. I thought he was going to be huge.
I don't dislike him. He just made a couple bad movies
and nobody calls him anymore, which is a shame. Same thing with it's the Josh Holloway thing from Lost. It's kind of the same deal. Finally, the director Joe Carnahan. You have any thoughts on him as a director? I feel like he's kind of like he likes action in the mold of Michael Bay, but without it being quite as leering at times. But you mentioned the A-Team. That's his earliest, or no, we've both seen Smoking Aces. We have not seen Narc, which is his most well-regarded movie by the Letterboxd users, at least. I do not like Smoking Aces. Do you like that movie?
No.
It's just a bunch of like one note characters all trying to be cool. And I really dislike that.
Yeah.
The A-Team is kind of fun. I don't think it's good. I think it's kind of bad, but I think it's kind of fun.
Again, he had kind of professional actors that were able to be in that. So you do get like not terrible performances by Charlotte Copte and Bradley Cooper and Liam Neeson, like, because they're just not really capable of a truly terrible performance. That probably saves it. Also, Bradley Cooper looking exactly like the guy who played Face in the 80s helped.
Yeah.
A little bit.
That's another movie where it kind of telegraphs who the big twist, the big turn, like the villain. The villain of the movie is the other guy you meet in the movie.
Yeah.
Suffers from the same problem.
Not Jessica Biel. It's got to be the other guy.
After the A-Team, he makes The Gray, which I watched for the first time this week. And I had a little trouble at the start really engaging with the movie when they're just sitting by the wreckage for a good bit of it. But once they start moving, I feel like the movie really starts moving. And it's really good.
It has a ending, The Gray does, that maybe we won't have whatever the movie's been out for like 25 years or 15 years. The ending, when I watched it, I thought was really cool, and then I like immediately felt a little bad about thinking it was cool. I was like, wait, was that cool, or was that just...
You mean like the ending, like the last,
like the reciting the poem? Yeah. Like the last scene. Did you like it, love it, hate it, not care about it? Did it seem like too much? Because it felt like it might be trying too hard.
No, I didn't. It didn't bother me. I didn't think it was like super cool. But I liked it because it's... I think it fits thematically with what that movie is about, which is kind of deep for philosophically for Carnahan movies.
Yeah.
But I think that movie is all about it. It's I think it's really interesting that it is a survival movie that is about accepting death in a lot of ways, and about how each character kind of gets visited by like good memories, and they bask in like in that moment of accepting that they're gonna die. And there's I don't think it's the most poignantly done version of this sort of, you know, philosophy or this sort of theme, but I do think it's effective in the movie. And I think that last shot is sort of about like it not mattering so much whether, you know, what the outcome is, as much as he has accepted that he's probably going to die, and that's that, and it's the acceptance of it that.
It's just weird because I feel like they put so much emphasis on him fighting for it, though. So there is something there, like it is a long setup of him like taping the glass to his hands. He's gonna try.
Yeah, it's not about giving up.
And there might be something there. But not about the outcome, like you said.
I do recommend The Gray for people who haven't seen it.
That was well said. You should say that again on our Gray podcast in a couple of years.
Stretch, I've not seen. Don't know anything about that movie. In 2021, he did Boss Level, which is a fun time loop action movie. I would say the tone is similar to something like Deadpool. Maybe not quite as jokey, but I would still say the tone is on par with that. It's a movie that does not take itself seriously. It stars Frank Grillo, finally getting a starring role. That was kind of nice. He's a henchman in, you know, dozens of movies that you've probably seen. And
yeah,
it's got Naomi Watts, who always like seeing Naomi Watts in movies. Mel Gibson, who I don't really need to see in movies much anymore, but he's there too. I would recommend it. It's on, I think it's on Amazon right now. Might be wrong.
You say Oscar winner, Michelle Yeoh?
It's fourth build in it. She's like barely in it. It's a strange, the worst part of the movie is he pops into this like Chinese restaurant a couple times too. And, part of the reason it's the worst part of the movie is because Ken Jeong is like the proprietor of the restaurant. And so you got to deal with,
he's laying it
on. Of course, there's no other way he knows how to lay it on. And there's no subtlety to Ken Jeong ever. And then Michelle Yeoh is just like a person who's there. And I don't know. Maybe I went and fixed myself a sandwich at the point where Michelle Yeoh's character became relevant in that movie.
Told him how to get out of the loop or whatever.
Yeah, I don't know, but it did not seem. And this is like right before she's in Everything Everywhere, so she was just sort of, you know, she wasn't maybe quite as in demand at that point. She should have been, but I don't know that she was. Then he makes Cop Shop. Oh, by the way, I do recommend Boss Level, but it is not a strong recommendation. Same year, 2021, he did a movie called Cop Shop, which has good reviews. I have not seen it, but I would like to. And then he did two movies last year. This is his third movie since the start of 2025, the rip is. He did Shadow Force and Not Without Hope, movies that I couldn't tell you the first thing about. And they don't have reviews that make me want to learn about them either. So, yeah.
There you go. I've still pulled up the Boss Level wiki page, and I'm like, man, I applaud you for watching this, because Mel Gibson, Will Sasso, and Rob Gronkowski, all in the same movie. I feel like I'd do a
fun. Mercifully, Rob Gronkowski has no speaking role in this movie. He appears as a machine gunner in a helicopter, and due to it being a time loop, he's in the movie frequently, but never says a word. Will Sasso, not great. He's like a henchman in that movie. A real serious henchman.
What's Will Sasso's Rushmore? Best in Show. Maybe tie it all back to Catherine O'Hara.
Well, that'll do it for the rip. Consider this film properly ripped by now. Ripped it. Let's see. Is there anything else we need to cover? How's it feel being back in the saddle again for the podcast?
I'm loving it. Excited for, I'm not sure. We're going to try to do maybe a top 10 episode. Those are always popular before, and hopefully some Oscar stuff, maybe with David.
We've got about 4 or 5 weeks till the ceremony?
39 days. I did the math earlier because I was like trying to figure out how many, I was like, is this even possible? So I was like, I finally wrote down the movies that are left because it's a reasonable amount of movies now that we've watched a few. And I was like, we don't have to do something stupid like watch a movie every day, do we? Because I honestly didn't know when the ceremony was. I knew it was in March. I was like, if this is March, like, 2, I'm not doing it. But it's March 15th, so we've got 5 weeks plus.
Cool. We'll definitely have something probably in early-ish March. Depending on when you finish your Death Race, and when I get done, and if David...
I think we'll at least try to get all the Best Picture noms watched and as much of the above the belt stuff as we can.
Yeah, that's always fun to go through. So, always enjoy the pre-Oscar podcast.
Yeah.
But anyway, hopefully we'll be doing this semi-regularly. We'll pick out another movie here soon, hopefully to give us a break from death racing. Or we'll pick a death race movie that's sort of out of the, I don't know, out of the norm. But anyway, I guess in the short term, what can people do? Subscribe to our podcast. You found it here.
Yes.
Wherever you're listening to it, that'd be a great place to start. Subscribe right there. And rate if they allow that sort of thing. I don't know. Does Spotify do rating? I mean, I definitely know because I'm a big Spotify user myself. But
yeah, I just hate ratings. That's it. Love Spotify.
I know that Apple does. They make them real easy to find how to rate podcasts on Apple. You have to navigate through several different URLs and really be deeply in search of it to figure out how to do that. But anyway, if you could rate and subscribe, that would be fantastic. But let us know if you listened, and let us know what you think, and let us know if you enjoyed The Rip.
The Rip. Is there a website we're working on too that
oh yeah
will be up maybe we write too
yeah
some of us better than others, but I think that'll go up on the
methodreactor.com. Same name as the podcast, so it should be easy to find.
don't make that mistake twice.
We figured got it out this time, everybody. Don't call your things three different things. Yeah. Anyway, well, that was fun, and looking forward to the next time we do this. So, thanks, TJ.
Thanks, Brent.
Bye.
Bye.